Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to our last weekend, no, our last lecture of the weekend. For those of you who camp out here and go to all the lectures, there really isn't another one after this one, so you can go home unless you're going to Bistro Banter at 4 o'clock. Bistro Banter, hosted by Howard Burton with David Rowe, Robert Shulman, and John Dawson up in the bistro. So please join us for that if you like at 4 o'clock. We are happy to welcome again David Rowe this afternoon. David Rowe studied mathematics and history of science at the University of Oklahoma and took a second doctorate in history at the Graduate Center of the City University, New York. He served as book review editor, managing editor, and editor of the journal Historia Mathematica. In 1992, David Rowe was appointed professor of history of mathematics and natural sciences at the Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz, Germany, where he presently teaches. His research is mostly focused on mathematics in Germany, but in recent years he has been concerned with Einstein's general theory of relativity and the broader cultural and political impact of Einstein's ideas. As part of this effort, he and Robert Shulman, who has been also lecturing for us this weekend, have co-edited a source book entitled The Political Einstein, Private Thoughts and Public Passions, scheduled for publication by Princeton University Press in 2006. Please welcome David Rowe.
Thanks, Michael. So you see my topic today has a great deal to do with politics, something that you've heard about now from Robert Shulman, and if you've gone to other talks, such as John Dawson's talk, you heard a bit about politics as well. The book you just heard about, this is the title again, and it deals with various themes in politics that come up in Einstein's lifetime, his various writings about these, and his private letters and so forth. So it's an attempt to get at both the inside personal thoughts and public expressions of those. So three topics come up in the course of that. And as you see, I'll be speaking here really about the second of these. But when you talk about Einstein, world government, peace, internationalism, all of these things, you really can't separate out these other two elements. I won't say much at all about cultural Zionism, but if you heard Robert's talk, you'll note the connectedness there. And of course, intellectual and human freedom is all over the place with Einstein. So these three elements are really there, despite the fact that I'll be really focusing in on the things that move toward this theme of world government. So this is one of the occasions where Einstein, of course, spoke to a group of young Jewish students. This is really during the time period when he's promoting cultural Zionism. But if we really want to look specifically at Einstein's political activity, and I want to emphasize he really was an actor and not just someone who moralized about politics. He valued action a great deal, as I'll emphasize here. That action didn't come at just any old time. He was doing physics a lot of the time, too. And so he actually reacted to events a great deal of the time. There are three primary periods in which he really is engaged in intense political activity. The first of these is right after the First World War, when his interest in Zionism first arises. And of course, the problems of world peace are all there to be seen very clearly in the European context. Things begin to smooth out a bit during the 1920s. He's hopeful that some kind of rapprochement between Germany and France will be reached. He's a member of the United Nations Committee on Intellectual Cooperation, and he's hoping through that group of intellectuals to sort of engage the cultural leaders of Europe in an enterprise that will help lead to some kind of international political arrangement. So this goes on throughout a long period of time. The culminating event of that, by the way, is the famous correspondence between Einstein and Sigmund Freud on why war. This famous exchange was actually initiated as a project by this committee, this League of Nations Committee. I hope I didn't misspeak. It's the League of Nations Committee on Intellectual Cooperation. So he's engaged, but there are these three periods, and I'd like to emphasize that these things really do charge Einstein to take up very practical issues of the day. And so his politics changes with time, and this has led very often to the charge that he was somehow naive about politics, that his pacifism was, he was a flip-flopper on pacifism and so forth, that he didn't really follow through on his principles and so forth. He addressed that, of course, many times, and so our source book is an attempt to also show the underlying consistency in the principles that he adhered to. But as in physics, Einstein was somebody who could pick up various strategies to pursue a problem. He was not fixated on any sort of dogmatic approach to politics. And so the second period, late Weimar, is associated with a phase of militant pacifism. Mainly, he's speaking in the United States during these three trips he makes. And he has a huge following and so forth. It's a particular tactic he takes at that time period. And I'll show you a little bit about that then. And then, of course, he notoriously changes his mind when Hitler comes to power and so forth. That tactic isn't working any longer. He makes it clear he's giving up on it, and he's adopting another strategy. I'll tell you then a little bit about the connection with the bomb, since that's such a famous chapter, the Manhattan Project and Einstein. More has to do, I would say, with the imagery and iconography of Einstein than the reality of it, because it's not one of the three phases of political activity you see here. If there was one theme that engaged him after 1933 up through the end of World War II, it was certainly the fate of the Jews. That was something he was deeply engaged in, but I won't speak about that here. However, after Hiroshima, a third phase of activity kicks in, where arms control and world government are the main themes at hand. And so I'll be talking about the second and third periods here. So this idea of naivete in politics is a long-standing one. It was reinforced when Time magazine named Einstein the person of the century, and wrote about him as the embodiment of pure intellect, the bumbling professor with a German accent, a comic cliche in 1,000 films. That presentation of Einstein is as a highly American version. He's not seen that way in Europe, but it's the old man in Princeton, the naive Einstein that is here reinforced by Time magazine. Well, in fact, he's a pragmatist in politics. We try to show that very forcefully. Just to give you one example, it's an important one, though. He was rebutting a critic of his views on world government shortly after the end of the Second World War. And in doing so, he stressed that one's strength of conviction must be, quote, based upon a clear understanding of the prevailing objective conditions. This is an absolutely typical statement of Einstein, that he's not interested in programmatic, idealistic, moralistic approaches to politics. He's interested in world problems and solving them. And he's not a loner. He's not a loner in this at all. We pick out a whole bunch of people in the book with whom he's in contact who are promoting similar causes. So here you see some very famous names: Sigmund Freud, Bertrand Russell, the mathematician Hilbert, the leading pacifist, French pacifist, Romain Rolland, his friend, his close friend, the physicist Paul Langevin, the Jewish leader with whom he was closest in the United States, that's Rabbi Stephen Wise. Here are pictures of some of these, the two most famous figures, Freud and Russell. Langevin, together with Einstein and Paul Ehrenfest, in Leiden, and Roland. And here he is, Einstein, together with Stephen Wise. But there were other figures as well, less known figures, but they're often more significant as allies in these stories. Of course, the name Leo Szilard is very well known, but not so well known are names like Georg Nicolai, Emil Julius Gumbel, Rosie Katz Schwimmer, Emery Reeves. And I'll be saying a little bit about especially Emery Reeves here. Well, there's the phase Einstein, the militant pacifist. This is his second phase, 1930 to 1932. And he's already, of course, making movements in this direction. Earlier, he came out in 1928 in support of the War Resisters International. But it's in returning to New York, he'd been to the United States once on this crusade with to raise money for Hebrew University in 1921. So he'd been to New York, it deeply influenced him when he was there before, but the next visit is December 1930. He calls the United States a bulwark of the democratic way of life, and this sort of hopeful vision for the politics of the United States is a huge, huge theme in his life. So something rather timely about that, too. And it's at a meeting then of the New History Society at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel that he delivers the most famous single speech he gives about politics at this time, the so-called 2% speech advocating what comes to be known as militant pacifism. So why the 2%? Well, here's the central quote that explains his strategy here. He tells the audience, the aim of all pacifists must be to convince others of the immorality of war and rid the world of the shameful slavery of military service. Even if only 2% of those assigned to perform military service shall announce their refusal to fight, governments would be powerless. They would not dare send such a large number of people to jail. A rather daring vision. Roland thought this was terribly naive at the time already. I mean, armies, of course, are not necessarily so dependent on human bodies any longer. The technology of war has, of course, developed rapidly by this time. But this was the tack he took. It made him very famous. The idea, however, seems to be inspired by a really unknown figure named Rosika Schwimmer. And she's, in fact, the person who speaks to the audience on this occasion because, of course, they don't understand German and he doesn't speak English. So it's rather a humorous event in a way that the translator who was picked out didn't get past the first sentence. When Einstein began to speak, the translator just sort of hemmed and hawed, and she got up and finished the job. So, however, this may have been the first encounter, the personal encounter with Rosika Schwimmer, but Einstein knew about this woman. She had been denied American citizenship for refusing to take an oath that required a promise to bear arms for the country. And he knew about this about 6 months earlier because he writes to the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Stuttgart, and says the following about this, learning about her situation. I consider Frau Schwimmer's stand of great value and deserving the support of all true humanitarians. Governments represent the people, and the people are still under the spell of obsolete traditions of military duty. World peace, a crying necessity, is not to be achieved unless spiritually progressive forces refuse to yield to public authorities, controlled by factions which should be defeated. Those convinced of this necessity should consider it their duty to uphold publicly this conviction. Thereby they bring upon themselves a conflict with public authority. A result can be obtained only if a large number of influential personalities have the moral courage for such an attitude. So this is already hinting, of course, in the direction of what becomes this 2% approach to pacifism. He further wrote here, such an attitude is revolutionary, but only through acts of rebellion can the fettered individual break chains which, though forged in laws, have grown into unendurable bondage. In this situation, too, such a recourse is unavoidable. Credit is due Frau Schwimmer for having realized this and having acted courageously in accordance with her convictions. So surely he met her on that occasion, and they were friends after that. Elsa Einstein writes many letters to her and so forth. A rather unknown but important figure in the political scene. Well, the main message, of course, here that underlies this militant pacifism of the period is don't moralize, but act. Real pacifists shouldn't behave like sheep. Just a few more citations out of this short speech, but famous speech. When those who are bound together by pacifist ideals hold a meeting, they are always consorting with their own kind only. They are like sheep huddled together while the wolves wait outside. I think pacifist speakers have this difficulty. They usually reach their own crowd, who are pacifists already. The sheep's voice does not get beyond this circle and therefore is ineffective. Real pacifists, those who are not up in the clouds, but who think and count realities, must fearlessly try to do things of practical value to the cause and not merely speak about pacifism. Deeds are needed. Mere words do not get pacifists anywhere. So this most famous speech, of course, makes the point very clearly that, and it's a very consistent thing you find in his other writings and pronouncements. He really thought pragmatically about politics. And this did not please everyone. There are three trips he makes to the United States. By the third round, there's enough political fallout that a group of patriots, let's call them, tried to prevent him from making that third trip. They tried to prevent him from getting a visa to visit the United States, and he was asked to come to the Berlin consulate, and he was interviewed, etc., etc. It's an interesting story, but I'll just give you his reaction to the Women Patriot Corporation attacks on Einstein. Of course, this got into the press, but then he makes this wonderful little reply. I guess it's a nice little Einsteinian text. His reply, never have I experienced from the fair sex such energetic rejection of all advances. Or if I have, never from so many at once. But are they not quite right, these watchful citizenesses? Why should one open one's doors to a person who devours hard-boiled capitalists with as much gusto as the Cretan Minotaur devoured luscious Greek maidens, and is so low down, or is low down enough, to reject every sort of war except the unavoidable war with one's own wife? Well, there is more than humor to this story. It's part of this actually ongoing resistance to Einstein's politics that will come out then in the McCarthy era and so forth. Behind it are people like Elizabeth Dilling, the author of The Red Network, a central source for the FBI. She, in that book, singles out Einstein, along with people like Gandhi and Jane Addams, as highly pernicious individuals and so forth. I mean, it's not so bizarre that there are people like this, but that the FBI took this stuff up so uncritically. That's the really astounding thing to realize. Eventually, though, during the Roosevelt administration, Elizabeth Dilling is prosecuted for sedition, successfully prosecuted for sedition. However, there is a much larger movement. Historians have written about the Mothers Movement in American fascism, not a theme that one typically knows about in American history because we're apt to think of the liberal era of Roosevelt and so forth, but not everyone was happy about that. And this is a huge movement, in fact, that was afoot. One of the central events of this era that Einstein promoted in a major, major way, it's also not been written about much in history, but typically you read a lot, of course, about Neville Chamberlain coming to Munich and so forth, and these sorts of things many years later. I think for Einstein, this was already the decisive, crucial defeat for internationalism. The 1932 Geneva Disarmament Conference, which he wrote about many times, he tried to get the American side to engage in it and take it very seriously. His basic attitude about disarmament is summed up in this brief statement: "To arm is to give one's voice and make one's preparations, not for peace, but for war. Therefore, people will not disarm step by step, they will disarm at one blow or not at all." The point of that remark was directed very much at the type of negotiations that were going on in Geneva. 50 different nations convened. It was, of course, a fragile time because the German government was on the point of collapse. The French were very worried about secret military buildups in Germany, and Churchill was screaming about that and so forth. And the United States, which had a very isolationist view of the world for a long time, to the extent they were interested in negotiations at that point, they were mainly thinking of the Japanese situation. So the naval strategy in the Pacific was mainly what was at hand. And the type of negotiation was really about weapon systems and things like this. So if you come down with this type of weapon system, maybe we'll come down on that one and so forth. Einstein thought this was just simply ineffective and would never lead to any kind of viable arrangement. Well, at this time period, he meets then a terribly interesting and central figure in his political career. And this is an interesting Hungarian by the name of Imre Révés, who later, as a British citizen in 1940, changes his name to Emery Reeves. He pops up in two places in Einstein's career. He's a political publicist in Berlin who knows Einstein very well. In fact, he's the one who's largely promoting Einstein's writings at this early phase. But after the war, the Second World War, he will meet Emery Reeves again. And Reeves is, in fact, connected with a little Hungarian trio when he studies in Zurich, John von Neumann, the famous mathematician, and William Feller, I think. I believe it's misspelled. He's an economist. So he studies economics originally, and he writes a dissertation, interestingly enough, about the economic and political views of the murdered German foreign minister Walter Rathenau. It is possible that this was the initial connection with Einstein, because that dissertation is actually to be found in Einstein's library. You see a copy of it. That's a rather unusual thing to have in your library. Well, there are other people who are talking about politics in Berlin at that time. On the left is the propagandist for the communists, Willy Münzenberg, and of course Joseph Goebbels, I think you know. So this is a highly polarized situation, and in fact Einstein has some small dealings with Münzenberg. In particular, after the Reichstag fire, Münzenberg puts out some propaganda about the Reichstag's fire and uses Einstein's name in a big way. This is the Arbeiter Illustrierte Zeitung, which was one of many types of things that Münzenberg put out. But Einstein is mainly interested, of course, in reaching a different audience, and this Révés meets with him in Kaput, in their summer home, and discusses in detail various writings about the Geneva Disarmament Conference, pacifism in general, what sort of strategies to employ, and so forth, and publicizes Einstein's views in various publications around the world. So Révés sets up a sort of network for publishing in the foreign language press articles by leading politicians, above all, but also cultural figures. So he has a handful of people like Thomas Mann and Albert Einstein, whom he regularly publishes as well. This thing grows into a huge network stretching over six continents. He has 400 different people involved, and these are not little people. His star writer is Winston Churchill, in fact. So they're pressing actually for some kind of democratic vision. This is a picture later of Reeves together with Churchill, and then they became friends after the war. And in fact, Churchill is so impressed with this guy, and he was so grateful for the publicity he gave him during the so-called wilderness years, that he gave him serial rights on all of his wartime memoirs for Life magazine. So that made Reeves a rather wealthy man, of course. And this is the book I'll be talking about just a little bit later, The Anatomy of Peace, which was a huge bestseller of the day and that Einstein and others promoted in a big way. Well, of course, this time period comes crashing to an end with the assumption of power of the Nazis, but Einstein followed this very closely all along. He's already, with the first election results of September 1930, sensitized to the danger of fascism, and he's writing about it. So it's this, in all of this pacifism stuff takes place as the Nazis basically crawl up into power. What's his initial response when they assume power to the new, what's his response to the new Nazi regime? Well, he issues, when still out at Caltech, what became his political manifesto, repeated many times. The original version of it here contains a direct statement about conditions in Germany, but the manifesto is this first portion here, his general statement that as long as I have any choice, I will only stay in a country where political liberty, tolerance, and equality of all citizens before the law prevail. Political liberty implies the freedom to express one's political opinions orally and in writing. Tolerance implies respect for any and every individual opinion. With respect to Germany, he went on, these conditions do not obtain in Germany at the present time. Those who have done most for the cause of international understanding, among them some of the leading artists, are being persecuted there. Well, it's of course in this context that he then renounces, famously so, renounces pacifism. And here you see as a tactic, not as a goal, of course. He remains in principle tied to this. Einstein got to know the King and Queen of Belgium from the various Solvay conferences he attended. And he's living in Belgium then when he returns from the third stay at Caltech. John Dawson mentioned it. He was sort of in limbo at that point. He was going to go to the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, but his situation in Berlin was no longer tenable, and so he's sort of biding time. He has various offers, obviously, from England and Spain and so forth. But in Belgium, after the assumption of the power by the Nazis, the issue of pacifism made people very nervous. And at one point, while he's staying there, he gets a message that the second fiddler would like to meet with him. The second fiddler was the Queen of Belgium, and she was concerned that Einstein come and talk to her husband about a particular case of some pacifists who refused to enter into the Belgian army. And so the king talks to Einstein, and Einstein then issues a statement to a French pacifist who had pressed this issue at the time. July 1933, what I shall tell you will greatly surprise you. Until quite recently, we in Europe could assume that personal war resistance constituted an effective attack on militarism. Today, we face an altogether different situation. In the heart of Europe lies a power, Germany, that is obviously pushing toward war with all available means. Belgium cannot possibly misuse its armed forces. Rather, it needs them desperately to protect its very existence. Imagine Belgium occupied by present-day Germany. Were I a Belgian, I would not, in the present circumstances, refuse military service. Rather, I would enter such service cheerfully in the belief that I would thereby be helping to save European civilization. This does not mean that I am surrendering the principle for which I have stood heretofore. I have no greater hope than that the time may not be far off when refusal of military service will once again be an effective method of serving the cause of human progress. So this will become his new position, rather consistently followed for some time, and he asked the recipient of this letter, by the way, to make those views known, which of course causes a huge uproar in the pacifist movement. And now events, of course, follow very suddenly in Berlin after that. There's the scandal with the Berlin Academy, where he resigns, but then they kick him out anyway, just to make sure everybody gets the message. He and Elsa give up citizenship, and there's a huge amount of propaganda, of course, directed, a huge campaign of propaganda directed against Einstein at this time. And then there's the famous burning of books and so forth. I haven't been able to determine that any of Einstein's writings were actually on lists of books that were to be burned and so forth. I mean, you could burn him in effigy, that was good enough. You didn't need to know about relativity theory, and it was his politics as much as anything, of course, that really, or more than anything, that distressed the right. But this takes place, and I bring it up for a reason, that the Einstein papers, his own personal scientific papers, escaped the flames somehow. And that's a story that's actually never been told, and of course that there's not a lot of evidence about what exactly did happen, but enough, I think, that you can get the picture that we wouldn't have an Einstein edition today had it not been for the location of his office. So the story is told by the housekeeper, Einstein's housekeeper, who worked out in Kaput, that's the summer house shown here, but also in the Haberlandstrasse apartment. And after the Einsteins were living in Belgium, she was still back in Haberlandstrasse with Ilse and Helen Dukas. And actually twice people came searching the apartment, and then the second time, they cordoned off the three women, told them to wait in a room, and then they went rummaging through the whole place and destroyed a lot of stuff, stole many things and so forth, but never reached Einstein's office. That story is told by the housekeeper. And so what happens? Well, Ilse and her husband, Rudolf Kaiser, are still present, and they managed then through the French embassy to get the Einstein papers moved off to Paris, along with other things. But so Rudolf Kaiser and Ilse play a huge role in this story. She's, of course, not only the eldest daughter of Einstein's second wife, but also his secretary for many years. So she's, of course, very intimately caught up in all of these events. And this is then where these papers were housed. Well, there's another part to this, just to connect it with the Einstein edition and what we know about Einstein's writings and so forth. Rudolf Kaiser had lost his job then in the early 1930s. He was a leading editor of the day. And Einstein gave him then permission to more or less cull whatever he wanted out of the papers and publish it in a book, Mein Weltbild, in 1934, and this thing contains many, many texts which even to this day are difficult then to, their provenance is difficult to determine. So I've called it here the decontextualized Einstein. It's been a huge headache for Einstein scholars to try to now fill in the pieces and figure out when and why Einstein wrote many of these things found in a volume like this. So this is part of a story with consequences, of course. Now let me get here to the bomb, just very briefly at least. The connection E equals mc squared and Einstein and so forth is, of course, post, and the bomb is post Hiroshima, but it was mentioned earlier that he was in fact denied clearance by the army to do any war research. And Here's the statement, in fact, in the file. Dr. Einstein, since being ousted from Germany as a communist, has been sponsoring the principal communist causes in the US, has contributed to communist magazines, and has been an honorary member of the USSR Academy since 1927. Well, you find everything you can possibly find and throw it together. It's clear they didn't want him on there. He did do some work for the Navy, of course, of a less potent variety, but he is connected then with the Manhattan Project, and famously, you know, you can talk about a father and grandfather of the bomb and so forth. Their attitudes, Robert had brought up yesterday, the attitudes of Oppenheimer and Einstein are terribly different. Oppenheimer was certainly from the beginning challenged technically somehow that this was an immense sort of thing to see if you could build this bomb. Einstein's main motivation for famously writing this letter to Roosevelt is political. He's deeply concerned that the Germans would get the bomb before the Allies. And of course, Leo Szilard is the key figure behind all of this. Without him, Einstein didn't even have any idea that you could practically, that a chain reaction could somehow be set off that would release so much energy, until Szilard came to him and they met, and then Szilard got him involved politically in this. This is, again, a copy of the letter. The famous letter in which FDR is tipped off about this work. Well, our book contains several other documents. I think this first one is the least important and least interesting in the story of how the bomb gets going. It's the British Maud project that really gets the Americans going, so it takes a long time, really, before the American government gets activated. There's a second letter which is somehow more revealing, but for time reasons I think I should just scoot on over it and get to the very last thing during the war related to the bomb where Einstein is involved, 6 months prior to Trinity, and that's when Niels Bohr gets a letter from Einstein, who learned from Otto Stern about the fact that it looked like they were now getting close to testing the bomb. And Einstein writes to Bohr, who's now located at the Danish embassy in Washington and is very connected with what's going on politically, and asks Bohr to do something in order to bring up the issue of using this terrible weapon, etc. And Bohr comes to talk to Einstein at his home on the 22nd of December, 1944, and takes notes from that conversation and so forth. But the gist of it was, don't complicate the delicate task of the statesman. Let's stay quiet here. And he was nervous that Einstein would, of course, if Einstein had gone to the press, I mean, this would have been all out in the open. So they were very nervous about that. So this, some images from the first successful test in New Mexico, and of course what follows with the two bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki is all familiar. But it's the post-Hiroshima era when Einstein really gets going again, and this connect is made. The imagery of Einstein, the eminent scientist, and the power of the formula equals mc squared, etc. Spencer Wirt has a very nice book called Nuclear Fear, in which he talks about this imagery of the day, so the impact of all of this on popular culture. It contains this passage: when scientists and the press collaborated in making Einstein, the old man, a prime symbol of nuclear energy, they were using the symbolism to insist that scientists, however wise and well-meaning, had released forces far beyond the ordinary ken. And it's, what's most interesting to me here is that Einstein could have easily said, you know, I'm not a nuclear physicist and I didn't know anything about it, et cetera, et cetera. But his reaction is quite different, in fact, because he sees an opportunity here. Emery Reeves has just published a book, Anatomy of Peace, and he sends it to Einstein. This is the letter that Einstein writes back that you surely can't read, I imagine, here. But he writes back to Emery Reeves, "I've read your book in 24 hours. I'm completely convinced this is a terribly important thing for everybody to read." And it's a systematic argument for world government. It's the same argument, though, that Reeves and Einstein had more or less worked out after the failure of the 1932 Geneva Disarmament Conference. So this isn't anything new to him in a way. It's just a much more elaborate historical presentation, very sharply argued. And this thing becomes a huge, huge success. You see the kind of advertising that was done with it here. This book may mean life or death to you. The book All America is Talking About, and so forth, and then they cite the various people. There was an open letter published in the New York Times and elsewhere promoting this book, and the former Supreme Court Justice, whose name escapes me at the moment, Roberts, thank you, Owen Roberts, was behind that. The letter contains this passage. "It happens that at this crucial moment of our history, a small book has been published, a very important book, which expresses with the utmost clarity and simplicity what many of us have been thinking and saying. We urge every American man and woman of goodwill to read this book, to think about its conclusions, and to discuss it with neighbors and friends, privately and publicly. A few weeks ago, these conclusions seemed important, but something concerning the future. With the reality of atomic warfare, they were of immediate, urgent necessity if civilization does not want to commit suicide." Well, Einstein really promotes this big time. They take a kind of phony facsimile letter here and lay it up over the book. This is supposedly then the letter that he wrote to Reeves. It's obviously an abbreviated version. Einstein lets his name be used here to promote it, but he also then makes his first post-war statement on the control of nuclear energy in an interview with the radio commentator Raymond Graham Swing. This appears in Atlantic Monthly and is republished many, many times. It appears, of course, in Ideas and Opinions and so forth. It's a standard Einstein text. And the point of that text was really, again, to simply alert people to the problem, and the full argument, he said, was to be found in this book. Let me close now with a few brief remarks about another phase, which is also in our book, and it's of some relevance to pick up the issues a bit later in the McCarthy era. Of course, Einstein took citizenship in 1940. He even helped, of course, make a big public statement at the time by there was a radio recording, "I'm an American." "I'm an American" was the title of it, something sponsored by the INS in order to make it clear why it is that Einstein decided to become an American citizen, and it's on this occasion that he again trots out that political manifesto that I read to you earlier. It's interesting then, in the McCarthy era, 10 years later, that the INS, supported by the FBI, began an investigation aimed at deporting Einstein. So it shows you how quickly things can change, and we might wonder how that happens. One place to look is Life magazine, where they tried to expose dupes and fellow travelers who were meeting together at a World Peace Conference in New York. In fact, it was, you could say, largely a communist front type thing, in that the Communist Party had a heavy hand in it and so forth. Einstein, over many years, was very sensitized to this problem. He's in no way naive about it, and he distances himself whenever possible as soon as he sniffs out that Moscow is behind it or something. But, you know, his name gets kicked around. He can't avoid it. Things get hot then, of course, after the Russians get the atom bomb in August 1949, and Truman then announces a crash program to build the hydrogen bomb. And a month after that is the famous speech of Joe McCarthy in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he claims that 205 members of the State Department happen to be members of the Communist Party. So it all happens rather quickly here, and the connection with Einstein gets very hot for the FBI. There are these types of sweeping claims. Einstein is either the chairman of, member, sponsor, patron, or otherwise affiliated with 10 organizations which have been cited by the Attorney General as being communistic groups. These types of things are all shot through the Einstein file that Fred Jerome wrote about. And then he goes on television in order to make his plea one more time for world government and some kind of international arrangement. On the television show Today with Mrs. Roosevelt, which probably didn't help him too much either in Hoover's eyes. They were not terribly friendly, Eleanor and J. Edgar. But really decisive are the rumors that go around that Klaus Fuchs, who's a huge embarrassment to the FBI, of course, he's the main spy they catch in England, the atomic physicist Klaus Fuchs, had come to the United States from Canada. He's a German citizen originally, so he's in Germany, then Britain, then he goes to Canada, comes to the United States, and the rumor is that he gets to the United States because Einstein wrote on his behalf. So this is the heavy charge behind the FBI investigation. But this is all, you know, you can find much of this in Fred Jerome's book. Hoover's obsession with Einstein, or the FBI's obsession. My impression, in a way, is that it's largely a bureaucratic obsession. I mean, if you work in the FBI, you've got to produce evidence, and I mean, what's most amazing is they've got 1,500 pages of largely repetitive third-hand charges and so forth. It's not really, I think it's more like trying to impress your boss or something. Einstein reacts to this in a letter to his friend, the Queen of Belgium, in March 1954. All manner of fable is being attached to my personality, and there is no end to the number of ingeniously devised tales. All the more do I appreciate and respect what is truly sincere. So the most famous open controversy involves then a Brooklyn science teacher who was asked to testify before a committee in Washington, and he comes to Einstein for help and advice and so forth, and Einstein writes this letter and asks that he make it public. It's published in the New York Times and so forth. And you know, if you heard Robert Schulman's talk yesterday morning, we kind of come full circle here to these issues he talked about back then in comparing people like Einstein and Oppenheimer. So at this point, it's absolutely clear to Einstein that one should not cooperate with these committees, and he wants to make that as plain as possible. And so he writes, if enough people are ready to take this grave step, that is, to refuse to testify, they will be successful. If not, then the intellectuals of this country deserve nothing better than the slavery which is intended for them. So this, I think, somehow captures the essence of this moral attitude, because morality and politics for Einstein were inseparable. I think it's a appropriate place to close. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert, for a fine lecture. Ladies and gentlemen, if we have we have some time for a few questions. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand, and one of our ushers will bring you a microphone. Sorry, was there a question? Oh, question down here, please.
Sorry, this isn't really a question, but just to kick things off, I wonder if you could comment on Einstein's relationship and some of the communication he had with Bertrand Russell.
Okay. I'm not exactly sure when they get to know one another personally, but of course Russell was a war protester, famously so, in the First World War, and Einstein was very well aware of that. So they're much in sync at that point in time. They diverge somewhat in their political views then with respect to the Soviet Union. So there's a sort of, during the Second World War and the period after that, Einstein is definitely to the left of Russell when it comes to that issue. Not that he's far from sympathetic, of course, to anything that has to do with totalitarianism and so forth, but he was very much against the vilification of the Soviet regime as he saw it. And he felt people like Russell were a little bit trigger happy, maybe, or that they were. Russell pressed quite far when there's a breakdown in the UN with the UN establishes an Atomic Energy Commission, and this is one of the big goals of Russell and Einstein and so forth, that there be an arrangement between the Americans and the Soviets about regulating atomic energy in the future. And this breaks down, of course. Gromyko is the negotiator, and this is a famous chapter in the beginning of the Cold War. After that happens, Russell reacts very, very differently than Einstein. Russell becomes adamantly anti-communist at that point. That was a step that Einstein didn't make. But of course, they're famously connected later on with the Pugwash conferences and so forth. So the very last thing, the so-called Russell-Einstein manifesto that's issued just as Einstein is dying, that's, of course, an ongoing legacy.
Other questions? Question over there, please.
Would you comment on any support or lack of support from Einstein for the cause, or for the situation facing Oppenheimer when he was bullied and mistreated by the McCarthy people?
Yeah. Perhaps a few of you heard Robert Schulman's talk yesterday where that came up very directly, and I mean, the difference in attitude that I alluded to here is that Einstein quite clearly didn't think that Oppenheimer was behaving, say, at this stage, of course, he has obvious sympathy for Oppenheimer when the whole hearing takes place in 1954. But earlier on, I think he sees Oppenheimer as far too dependent and somehow in need of approval from government authority and so forth. So Einstein, being, of course, someone who stressed the individual's independence and integrity of judgment, found once things became embroiled, I mean, Oppenheimer's success was very much as an organizational leader. Einstein had none of those abilities at all, never strove to do anything like that, and ultimately, I think many of his statements suggest that he almost despised that type of personality, independent of the case of Oppenheimer himself. But I think he clearly, of course, was very unhappy about the case made against Oppenheimer, but of course, it was largely Oppenheimer's security clearance would have simply run out. You know, this was a largely symbolic gesture that he was meant to be humiliated. That's what they wanted to do. They achieved it. And Einstein simply thought, this is stupid. Just don't participate. And that was his attitude.
One last question up here.
It's now 50 years since the time we're talking about. We're still no closer to having a world government. What do you think Einstein's stance would be now?
Well, I can't say anything, obviously, more than just speculate, but it's very clear in his lifetime that he was, over a long period of time, quite clear that this wasn't going to be an easy thing to achieve. He didn't expect it to happen suddenly or anything like that. I think he was mainly interested in the educational side of that, that people be informed that if things don't move in that direction, that any other course is likely to lead. I mean, we tend to talk about this as if it's so far in the past, but, you know, 50 years in the course of human history isn't really such a long time. People tend to think of the nuclear dangers and things like this and somewhat take it for granted, but they're all still there, of course. It's largely a psychological thing, and it's an educational thing. And Einstein certainly believed that people needed to understand in the long-term sort of vision of what's going on, that it's important to understand what's at stake, and that wars come about through conflicts, and that conflicts can only really be regulated. I mean, the type of analogy that Emery Reeves uses is we can take the case of Europe today, but he took the case of the individual states in the United States. You had a civil war, of course, in the 19th century. You had all kinds of tensions. And after a while, these things, you don't think about, you know, Tennessee going to a war with Ohio or something like this. In Europe today, too, you can see many signs of a completely different sort of attitude about things that make it somewhat almost unthinkable, you know, that war between certain states would take place. And take the case of Germany and France, they were arch enemies for so long. So the attitude of Einstein would certainly be taking the bigger picture of things. World government is necessary in order to have a higher instance of power that can regulate and dampen out any kinds of tensions that could lead to serious war and conflict.
So I'd like to take this opportunity to not only thank David for his lecture this afternoon, but also for taking the time to spend the past few days with us at Perimeter Institute.
My pleasure.
Being part of Einstein Fest. Very much appreciated, David.
Thank you.